You've been critical of the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, particularly as the basis for a constitution. Is there a sense, though, that parliamentary sovereignty and popular sovereignty are similar to each other in that parliament is elected every 4 or 5 years by the people, and to make it sovereign is therefore democratic?
Yes, what a terrifying fallacy that is. I mean, yes, of course, that is the version that we're given. That's the argument, and it's the argument that I simply couldn't understand. Who on earth voted for a system that puts a juggernaut of policies from one party, a very similar juggernaut from another, and says once you vote for either of these parties and they're in power, they have absolute supremacy over you and over Parliament because they are the dominating party. And if you don't like it, after 5 years or perhaps slightly less sometimes in the past, you can throw the rascals out. Well, my feeling about that is that's not democratic because we have all been put into a situation in which that is a given. We're told that that is how we're governed. We've never voted for that. I'm not conscious that any generation has ever voted for parliamentary sovereignty. And so that's why I say ultimately that version of democracy is not democracy.
And what virtues does constitutional sovereignty have over and above parliamentary sovereignty?
Well, I think we've got to be realistic about this. I mean, I've done cases out in Fiji where the president, when he didn't like what the court said about his constitution, tore it up, essentially started again. So no constitution is ever going to be perfect. I accept that. But what I think what I call popular sovereignty would give us, i.e., authority, as in the American Constitution, derived from the people, is first of all a higher source of authority than Parliament, a source of authority that all the institutional players in our Constitution have to obey. That would lead to far less tensions between judges and Parliament, and actually far less tension between Parliament as a whole and the executive, because everybody would realise there was this higher form of authority. Second thing I think, and this is very much on a much more practical level, I think that if people were much more involved in politics, involved in ideas about the Constitution, involved in our constitutional arrangements, which would happen if we had a citizens' branch, and would, I think, happen more if the people were viewed as the source of authority, I think you would cease to have this terrifying retreat from voting. I can't give you the statistics, but we all know membership of political parties has gone right down since the war, and voting has gone right down in national elections. So I think we would have a more honest framework, and I think we'd have a more participative framework, and therefore I think to that extent having a codified constitution would be a great step forward.
There is an issue with any written codified constitution that it solidifies current arrangements to some extent, including some possibly undemocratic arrangements like an unelected House of Lords. At present, if Britain wrote down its constitution, it may be left with that situation. How do we approach that problem?
Well, first of all, 99% of the world's democracies seem to have managed it okay. I think it's worth mentioning that nobody voiced the virtues of an unwritten constitution until we started doing it in the mid-19th century. Because what happened was that we were drafting constitutions left, right and centre for our colonies. The irony was we didn't have one for ourselves. And so what you find creeping into the Hansard parliamentary debates after you get a spate of constitution drafting is our parliamentarians basically saying, well, actually the unwritten constitution has a great virtue because it has all these values that are almost indefinable. And I noticed that LSE's Professor Martin Loughlin, in his excellent book on the constitution, talks about the traditional values that we have, which you can't necessarily write down. Now, my answer to that is, A, you can write down values, and B, once you have a document, that document will cease to be a simple document, but it will develop an organic and a dynamic nature of its own. It will be invested with values, not all of them, which will necessarily be written down, but it will acquire a kind of status.
But for a written constitution to be dynamic, it would need robust mechanisms for changing that constitution, and there's always a balance between having permanent features and being able to change it, and how easily can you change it. What do you think the ideal situation is in terms of those change mechanisms?
Well, I think you've got to have change mechanisms. And I should start by a confession, really, which is that when I sort of got into this big idea of drafting a constitution, somebody actually put to me what Thomas Paine said, which is no generation should be bound by the previous generation. So my first point, I think, is that we should have a constitutional review, call it a convention, every generation. We can work out what a generation means, but I think we should do that. So nothing is forever set in stone. But secondly, I think you can have mechanisms in a constitution, amendment mechanisms, which can be carefully layered. And in my book, what I've suggested is that certain provisions of the constitution should be inviolable. Torture, for example, and that there are other, what I would call absolute values. Another generation perhaps might say no value is absolute, but I think that's an absolute value, and there are others. So I would suggest that we have certain mechanisms saying this cannot change, but otherwise you should have a pretty high threshold for being able to change, and it should involve the people. So I think in my book I suggest X percent of the population would have to trigger a constitutional change, and then Y percent, a higher percentage, would actually have to vote that change in. That, I think, is a possible mechanism. It's not the only mechanism. But I just think this idea that one extreme version of parliamentary sovereignty, that you can change any law you like, even a constitution, by a simple majority, is terrifying.
You would still accept that the fundamental principle would be that EU law would have primacy over even UK constitutional law?
Well, no, I think that's a false antithesis. I mean, I think that European Union law has a doctrine of supremacy of European Union law. So if we subscribe to an international treaty that ratifies an obligation towards Europe, that's a legal obligation. Now, a constitution would have to deal with that. A constitution would either subordinate everything but supranational obligations to the Constitution, or it would say, in a case of conflict with Europe, the Constitution is supreme. I mean, the simple point is that we don't have the opportunity, under our current informal Constitution, to resolve what I think is getting an increasingly tangled approach to our global relationships and obligations. With a Constitution, it's open to us to decide how to do that. In my book, I actually do retain the supremacy of European Union law. But, I mean, there's nothing mechanistic about this. A constitution could give judges, unelected judges, total power. It could give them very little power. Ditto with Europe. I mean, it's as simple as that. What goes into the constitution, to my mind, is not as important, though it is important, as the process of drafting it and engaging us in that.
Part of the LSE's project is to crowdsource the constitution, involving the public as much as possible in the drafting process. How do you see the balance between expert input and public input working in that kind of project?
Yeah, that is a problem that I thought about when I was writing the book, and what I did was produce a draft Act of Parliament. And the way I would suggest is this. First of all, I think if we want to get this through, you've got to start with experts. So experts draft a constitution, but it doesn't matter almost what. You could use the one in my book, for example. You could use the LSE one at the end of this process. What you do is you first of all put to the people the question, the referendum question, should we have a codified constitution? If the answer is yes, and I think I put in my book, 60% have to vote yes. You could reduce that to 50, but whatever. That's the first referendum. And that is an exclusively expert production, I think. Needn't be. I suppose you could involve the people even at that stage. But just to get something going. And then they vote. Now, assuming they vote for the principle of a constitution, you put in the second referendum, you put this version of a constitution to them. They decide, are we going to accept this in full or not? Now, if they don't accept it in full, you then have a legislative process for producing a, if you like, a crowdsourced constitution. What I would suggest is that experts should ultimately be responsible for drafting it, because people can't draft a constitution easily, I would have thought. LSE might prove me wrong there. But what would happen is that you would crowdsource, you'd have public meetings, you'd have citizens' groups, you would have full public consultation, and you would ensure that on the panel that was going to draft this constitution, you had a representative sample of the public on that panel. And actually, specifically, some people who knew nothing about constitution drafting, but knew quite a lot about the values they thought were representative of the public interest. And at the end of that, the people having originally voted for a codified constitution, and B, not the one they were first put up, would have also voted for this process.